Who won the war and who initiated the peace? For this Reformation Society, wanting to particularly look at this whole situation, because this affects us all. This really has a lot to do with what we're in right now. We're facing all kinds of talk, farm invasions and all the rest of it. I saw an obnoxious film just a while ago called The Recce. Now, when you look at this, you get the impression, gee, this could be a really good film. I mean, the reconnaissance commander, special forces, great people. About time we had a film giving credit to where credit is due, and it seems even to the family behind. And so this looked like a really good film to see, but this was really disturbing. Very, very obnoxious. This is political propaganda paid for by Department of Trade and Industries at the NDC, DTI. So they help fund us. And this film basically makes out the reconnaissance commander to be worse than the terrorists they fought, the Russians to be the nicest people out there. It's so unrealistic. This general, I would have thought they would have done better. You might recall this chap who plays Corporal Fillion. He's in Born to Win, plays a lot of good films. I was horrified that he agreed to play this. Now, of course, film makers don't always let the people involved in it know what they're going to do in the editing department and so on. I understand that. But in this film, this general is always drunk. He's drinking incessantly on duty. He's obnoxious. He's callous. He makes dumb comments like, I've sent so many young men to their deaths, I can't even remember the names and I don't want to. Now, I know a number of generals who are in the SADF, like General Constant Fillion and General Heldenhaes and Kurt Liebenberg, who was, in fact, the general in charge of special forces about the time they're talking about this here. And, of course, General Mulder, dedicated Christians, people who really cared, fiercely loyal for their men. They certainly wouldn't have said callous things like, you know, I don't care and things like this. And this general's meant to send an assassin to assassinate him when they find out that their operative has survived this operation. Now, why would you do that? Because, for example, when we had a recce that we thought was lost and killed up in Angola, and he later survived and came back, he was welcomed back as a hero. They didn't have to send an assassin to kill him. I mean, that's insane. What's also bizarre is the chap in the middle, this captain, he's wearing a personnel or admin beret, a beige beret, and he's giving instructions to this recce. Now, you don't see Fort Doppies, you don't see Fort Rev, you don't see any of the place that the recce's would deploy from. And no recce would be getting his instructions from someone not wearing a maroon beret of the recce's or maybe a black beret of the intelligence corps. But you wouldn't get personnel or admin giving instructions to a recce for some deep secret mission beyond there. So that's bizarre. What's also strange is the general's sitting back in Pretoria, and he's not even on the border. It's not even at Ndangwa. It's not even at the Bastion in Windhoek. It's in Pretoria. And this captain, who's got nothing to do with the recce's, is the only chain of command going between the general and this corporal. And by the way, on the recce website, it calls Corporal Fillion Captain Fillion. So they obviously can't even get those two stripes on the shoulder right on their own website. You immediately can see when you watch the film, this isn't Angola. In fact, it was filmed in the Cape, and it's obviously not Angola. I mean, immediately looking, I know Angola. I know Angola well. There's termite mounds everywhere. There's baobab trees, there's makalans, there's savanna, but this looks like the Cape, and it looks like the Cape all over, and you can tell when you go onto the website, they say for authenticity, this was filmed in Bavianskloof and so on. That's not authentic to Angola. And it's none of the Angolan terrain. And in this recce, does weird things, like when he's running out of ammo and he's being pursued by the enemy, he's firing into the dark on all sides blindly at night because he hears hyenas. You know, that's not exactly what recce's do. These are the terrorists that he's following. The funny thing is, in this film, every time he's got to ambush somebody, he cocks the firearm immediately before initiating the ambush, like he wouldn't carry around in the chamber in operational era. You know, the mechanism of chambering around is very loud, and it gets rid of all chance of surprise. At any rate, this earringed character is assigned by the general to go and assassinate his recce. And he's meant to be so deep cover, but he can be flown in a helicopter by the South African Air Force, and that's still deep cover. At one point, the recce, who, by the way, is totally solo, and for the life of me, I don't know that our recces ever went solo. They went in groups of four, maybe two on a rare occasion. The only recce I ever heard who ever did a solo was Chris Schulenburg, and that was when he was in the Salu Scouts in Rhodesia, and that was considered so bizarre, not even Rhodesians did solo ops. But the South Africans never did, for sure. I've never heard of anything like this. So they send him alone, and by the way, every night he's making fires and on infiltration, exfiltration, fires, open cookout things and so on. At one point, there's a conveniently saddled horse, and he's doing a secret infiltration in Angola, and he gets on this horse and he rides across the veld, and you're thinking, how do you possibly maintain a covert entry? But anyway, it's terrible. It portrays the South African army as worse than the terrorists and the Russians and so on. Oh, and once he gets the radio and he radios base, he then abandons the radio. Which, why would you do that? He manages to get captured when he goes into a habitated village. Why would you go into a habitated village when you're doing an infiltration? And then later, after he escapes, and that's also bizarre as to how he even escaped, but anyway, he's running in the middle of a river, in the middle of a huge valley, where he can be seen for probably a couple of miles around, and then he gets shot in the middle of the island, in the middle of a river. Well, no cover, no concealment. You know, honestly, our admin corps would do better. Infantry would never do that sort of thing. As for reconnaissance commander, like, completely impossible. So it ends up with the SADF general ordering the assassination of his own guy for happening to survive when they had first thought he had died over there. And the whole scenario, everything about it's bizarre and ridiculous. And you can just see even here, that is not Angolan terrain. This is the Cape. But anyway, 4 years ago, as South Africa marked 20 years since the first one-man, one-vote election in South Africa, we were subjected to an extraordinary amount of propaganda inverting reality and rewriting history. And if you were to believe films like Mandela Long Walk to Freedom, which came out at the end of 2013, if you were to take at face value the pronouncements from our politicians and news commentaries and documentaries on SATV, which is the voice of the ANC, it would appear that the ANC won the war, and they were gracious and merciful to their defeated enemies. That's the impression you get. In fact, the reverse is true. There can be no doubt that the South African Defence Force won the war. As a military force, the ANC's Umkhonto we Sizwe, MK, Spear of the Nation, was a failure. I mean, even the picture chosen for the cover of the official book here is embarrassing. This chap's got an ironed outfit that hasn't even seen any dirt. He hasn't crawled in it. This is as fake as anything. They never operated in those uniforms anyway. And this picture, this idiot here doesn't look like he knows the slightest thing of what he's doing. Quite aside from the fact he's got his finger on the trigger, which you're not meant to do till you're ready to shoot. But if this is the best cover they could put on, you know, we could put pictures of actual soldiers that actually fought in a war. All they can do is put some model on. And it is not convincing. But not only was the ANC's MK a disaster, the Pan-African Congress's UPLA was even more a disaster. Yes, they managed a few high-profile terrorist attacks like the Church Street bombing. They managed to kill 20 people there in Church Street and injure a lot of people. And 19 dead, more than 200 injured. That was one of their successes. And they managed the St. James Massacre, where they murdered 11 people, died ultimately, and another 50 were seriously injured. But they were never able to defeat the South African Defence Force in battle. In fact, they could only operate as terrorist movements, planting landmines, limpet mines, suitcase bombs, and car bombs. These were the kind of displays that we had in every shopping centre around the country, because you had to be able to identify the stand weapons. All these Soviet manufactured, from landmines to different grenades, limpet mines, and so on. And this is normal. We used to see it everywhere because these were the weapons they used. And this was because they're attacking civilians and they like to use shopping centers as a target. They engaged in necklace murders and assassinations. Every time the SADF attacked, the guerrillas or freedom fighters or terrorists were defeated and the survivors fled. Now here you can see Cuban soldiers training with the MKs up in Angola. And I don't think that they know what they're doing either. This is also true for SWAPO in Southwest Africa, Namibia, and Angola. This is what SWAPO characters look like. Very well equipped, good Soviet weaponry. But what they were doing was, at best, they could lob a whole bunch of mortars at a base from maximum distance, and they'd have maximum amount of mortars in the air, and before the first one fell, they're fleeing. They left their mortar tube there, and they just fled because they knew the moment the first bomb fell, our guys would be triangulating, coordinating, and a response would be coming so fast. And we still often caught them because it didn't matter how fast they ran, our guys got them. So when they managed to lob a couple of mortars into Ondangwa or Oshakati, I mean, it was just a token, but they never really actually did anything significant. They did manage to plant a lot of landmines. This is classic SWAPO activity. That's the best they managed to do. Blow up a vehicle in a dirt road. In a 26-year war, SWAPO managed to murder 10,000 civilians, many of them by landmines. And this is the result of it. Notice, this is not armored cars. This isn't getting SADF people. This is getting civilians. Civilians. Those were the main targets of their bombings. And this person's hands tied up and then, of course, shot in the back. Buses. This is the Kalahari Sands bomb blast, car bomb. I was actually in Windhoek when this happened, and our good friend Des Radmore dashed in immediately after, checked around to see if there's anyone else, if there's any other bombs to be disposed of. He, Des Radmore, was the main bomb disposal person. He got an enormous crooks for all sorts of things, including dismantling an unknown bomb of Soviet origin in Kaiserstrasse, the main street. Nobody had ever seen one of these bombs before, and he sort of, oh, that's interesting. And he's that kind of person. He is a real courageous genius. This is what it looked like where the car bomb went off and what it looked like from the outside. Limpet mine suitcase bombs in shops. This is up in Ondangwa Butchery. This is the Ondangwa Post Office. These were the highlights of SWAPO's terrorist campaign. But they were never able to hold any ground in Southwest Africa. Even the external bases in Angola, protected by Cuban, Soviet, Angolan, MPLA, FAPLA forces, were destroyed whenever the South African Defense Force attacked, such as at the battle in 1978, which Colonel Breitenbach led on, where they dropped in Operation Kasinga, took out the terrorist headquarters at Kasinga. Our chaps captured a lot of Angolan T-54s, T-34s, T-62s. Even when they were dug in, didn't save them. At the height of the Cold War from 1985 to 1988, the SADF faced increasing confrontations with Soviet MiG fighter bomber jets and Mi-24 Hind helicopter gunships. Like this book by David Mennell, On the Day a South African Armored Battalion Shattered Angola's Last Mechanized Defensive. Now, this is the kind of weaponry we were up against. On the other side, they had MiG-17s, MiG-21s. This is the worst. Mi-24 Hind helicopter gunships, the flying tank. This was absolutely the worst thing we face in the field when these chaps come and chew up the ground. These massive rocket launcher pads, they've got a 20mm machine cannon nose. Very bad. This is what you don't want to see when you're on the ground. And Russian MiG-29s were coming in also towards the end of the 80s, massively out-technologing our Mirages. We had on our side Second World War vintage DC-3s, or what the Americans call C-47s. We've flown those a lot. And these are the old Sabres. This is what was being used up in the Korean conflict. Our Impalas were excellent ground attack weaponry. You can see some of the Buccaneers. Those were some of the best heavy bombers available in the SADF. And our Mirages on the ground. And the Mirages, as they got upgraded to being the Cheetahs, this was the best we had, but they were years out of date compared to the MiG-29s. But with economic sanctions, there's limits to what we could do, the Puma. And then this was not produced in time to be of use in the war in Angola, but it was being produced to counter the MI-24. And this is our Rooifalk, which the Americans call the Apache. And this would have been the equal of an MI-24, but the Cubans left before we could deploy those. So this was what you would see up at Ondangwa, Sector 10 airbase, bunkered in, Mirage waiting to go to intercept if the Cubans or Soviets decide to scramble. And so here you can see these are the cheetahs heading out. These are our Mirage 3s upgraded with super technology to be able to handle the... Although they had better equipment, our people had better pilots. And so here you can see the Mirage with the kind of weaponry they were able to carry and in flight heading off. Now, this is why they get patent camouflage from above and blue from underneath. So if you're on the ground, you're looking up, it's hard to spot them. If you're above looking down, it's hard to spot them as well. I mean, camouflage works even for aircraft in the bush. And here's one of the air-to-air missiles going off. And there's a number of dogfights that took place up there, and these have been documented. And here you can see actually the camera on board Mirage observing all that's involved in taking out the MiGs. And there's a whole number of these dogfights that our people won up at the border. Although most people are not aware of it. Occasionally, like first time in 1982, I think this first time I saw it, at a Russian MiG was shot down. This was quite a shock at the time. What? They've got MiGs on our border? Yes, they do. Here you can see some of the flight cameras. And this is an Mi-24 hand helicopter gunship being taken down by one of our Impalas. There were massive ground offensives by Cuban mechanized divisions in Angola in the last hot battles of the Cold War. Ops Hooper, Ops Modular, up in Angola. Being deployed by air, generally our guys had to walk in. I had no idea we had so many tanks in the army. But they suddenly appeared in 87, 88 at the border. Like, where did they come from? Well, actually by railway. But it was very expensive to run these things on the ground. And suddenly we had this massive concentration of tank power. This is up at Oshivelo, where 61 Mechanized Battalion Group was. And suddenly realized, boy, we've got an armored fist. What do we need tanks for up at the border? Well, the other side were moving a lot of tanks and we had to counter. One of the best weapons the SADF had in the final years of the war was the G5. This 155mm howitzer. And the mobile version was called the G6. But these G5s are so good. The Americans were buying them from us for their Gulf War I because they had nothing as good as this. The Americans didn't have anything as good as this. In fact, no one had anything as good as this at the time. Saddam Hussein was buying them. Our G5s, 155mm howitzers, were absolutely the best in artillery that's been made to date. you want ear protection when these things go off. And they pulverized the living daylights of the Cuban divisions. Now, this is an old 5.5-inch. This is like Korean War, Vietnam War vintage, but our guys had those up there too. On every occasion, the SADF decisively defeated the Soviet and the Cuban forces. General Yanni Heldnes wrote, "We were there, winning the war for Southern Africa." And documenting the enormous Soviet mobilization in Angola and the staggering losses that they endured at the hands of the SADF, General Heldnes quotes their sources. General Yanni Heldnes, like his predecessor, General Constant Viljoen, was a general who led from the front. He was not afraid to be with his men in the front line and behind enemy lines. He quotes from Soviet Lieutenant Colonel Igor Zadarkin, who was a participant in the Angolan War. Here's Zadarkin posing with one knee. In fact, this is the American, we called it Snotnius. Yeah, but it's a grenade launcher. Later, this was improved. This was M79, is it? I think that's what the Americans called. The Americans used those in Vietnam. Well, our Colonel Des Radmore made the multiple grenade launcher, which was super duper, the first infantry carried handheld multiple grenade launcher, but this is something that I presume he captured from UNITA, because we would have probably made those available. Zadarkin's book, We Did Not See It Even in Afghanistan, published by the Russian Academy of Science Institute for Africa Studies, attributes the fall of the Soviet Union to the ripple effects of the disastrous defeat suffered by the Russians and the Cuban allies in Angola at the hands of the South African Defense Force. So the Russians attribute the beginning of the end of the Soviet Union to that. We Did Not See It Even Afghanistan memoirs was, and here you can see in both Russian and English, and this chap got quite a lot of campaign medals while he's about it. So here's Soviet officer Igor Zadarkin posing in Kuwaita Carnival sometime close to Ops Hooper and Modular back in 1987. He quotes from José Malhaz's book, Angola, the Beginning of the End of the Soviet Union. José Malhaz is of Portuguese origin and he's based in Russia. His first book's title was The End of the Soviet Union, Angola, the End of the Soviet Union. His second book was called Angola, the Beginning of the End of the Soviet Union. Now, we know that this is a complex situation. There were Bible smugglers strengthening the persecuted church throughout the Soviet bloc and Eastern bloc. There were Christian radio stations broadcasting in, which was undermining the Soviet Union. There was the Leipzig prayer meeting, people mobilizing prayer meetings all throughout the East bloc. There were Afghan Mujahideen fighting in Afghanistan. There were the Contras in Nicaragua. There was RENAMO in Mozambique. There was UNITA in Angola. There were a lot of forces in play against Soviets. But these people from Russia attribute the beginning of the end of the Cold War in the Soviet Union to their defeats in Angola. And so here's some of Mihalish's books speaking about the history of Angola leading to the defeat of the Kremlin. Carlos Pacheco, a Brazilian historian, wrote the preface to Mihalish's book, The Fracas of Soviet Expansionism. Expansionism, that's a 20th century term for imperialism. But, of course, the two greatest empires of the 20th century are still in denial that there were empires. The Americans and Russians decry imperialism, even while they exhibit all the evidences of being empires, and they're still in denial that there were empires. The Austrians know there were an empire. The French knew they had an empire. The British knew they had an empire. But the British and Americans thought, no, we weren't empires. And the Chinese also claim they're not an empire, even while they're ruling how many places like Tibet and so on. But anyway, the fracas of Soviet expansionism. The first priority of the Russian expansionism in southern Africa was not so much important in terms of materials, but above all about politics. He emphasized it was the Republic of South Africa that the Soviets had their sights on. Angola was only a stepping stone towards a mineral-rich strategic South Africa. And here's the Russian tanks in their streets in Huambo, marching in Luanda, Cubans, and Russian missiles in Angola. And there's old dear Uncle Fidel Castro, along with drunken psychotic Marxist post Agostinho Neto. Notice the Cuban flag and the Angolan flag at the Luanda airport. This is a classic propaganda pic taken by our people, by South Africans, during operation in Angola. I think this was Op Smokeshall, 1980. Now, these pictures doubtless were on the wall, but they placed Fidel's picture and Brezhnev's picture against the window to show a composite picture. That's South African officer and South African soldier with the very typical South African bush hat, and that's a Russian P-76 amphibious tank or armored car. Then on the walls you can see SWAPO posters, and then you can see the Soviet rank structure and papers and so on. So this is a picture our people took just to show where they're at their terrorist training base. This is a picture captured. It shows two Russian commissars giving lectures to SWAPO, and on the wall you see the Marx brothers, Karl Marx, Frederick Engels, Vladimir Lenin, and there's Dos Santos, the dictator who took over from Agostinho Neto when he died suddenly. And that is the Vietnamese flag. What on earth is a Vietnamese flag doing in Angola? Well, this is just part of the Communist International. Chester Crocker, U.S. Secretary of State, Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, in his book High Noon in Southern Africa, Making Peace in a Rough Neighborhood, he reported, now quotes from him, not because I think he's a nice man. He certainly wasn't any friend of South Africa's, but it's always good to get your enemies and unbiased observers, or even biased observers' perspectives. So he says, U.S. Secretary of State for Africa. In early October 1987, the Soviet FAPLA offensive, FAPLA is the forces of the MPLA in Angola, was smashed at the Lomba River near Mavinga. It turned into a headlong retreat over the 120 miles back to the primary launching point at Quetzaltenango. In some of the bloodiest battles of the entire Civil War, a combined force of some 8,000 UNITA fighters, these are some of the UNITA troops we were ministering to at that very time before as they were marching out to go and face the Cubans. And so these are the UNITA allies of South Africa, and 4,000 SADF troops destroyed a FAPLA brigade and mauled several others out of a total FAPLA force, some 18,000 engaged in the three-pronged offensive. This is a Soviet tank, something like 60 tons, direct hit by one of our G5s, so it's 155mm howitzer. This is the end result. Imagine a force that can lift a 60-ton tank up in the air, break it into pieces, and smash it down on its back. That's what a 155 G5 can do. Estimates, I'm still quoting from Chester Crocker, estimates of FAPLA losses ranged upwards of 4,000 killed and wounded. The offensive had been a Soviet conception from start to finish, and senior Soviet officers played a central role in its execution. Over 1,000 Soviet advisers were assigned to Angola in 1987. To help with Moscow's largest logistical effort to date in Angola, roughly $1.5 billion in military hardware that was delivered that year. There are whole websites and Facebook sites set up by Russians who fought in Angola, with some of their campaign medals and of course, the Soviet flag, the Angolan flag, the present Russian flag. And these are the different districts. What we called Kawanda Kabanga province, they called the 6th district. Of course, they divide things up as military districts, regions. And here's some of their pictures that we can get in their websites of Soviet military advisors in Angola. This is the first multiple grenade launcher ever captured. It was captured during Op Smokeshall 1980, and Des Radmore did the specs on it, published it in Jane's Defense Weekly, because no one in the West had ever gotten their hands on us before. We were finding some really exotic material over in Angola. Here's some happy snaps by Russians encamped near the Lomba River during the Battle of Quetzaltenango, taken 1987. Huge quantities of Soviet equipment were destroyed or fell into UNITA and SADF hands when FAPLA broke into disorganized retreat. And this is shopping in Angola. It's more blessed to give than to receive. So South African Defense Force donated this to UNITA Freedom Fighters to fight against the communists in Angola. Red Arrow missiles, the same kind that took out the Rhodesian Viscounts and civilian airliners. These are heat-seeking missiles that we had to face. The 1987, still quoting from Chester Crocker, the 1987 military campaign represented a stunning humiliation for the Soviet Union, its arms, and its strategy. So this isn't South African war propaganda. This is what the Americans were saying at the time. At one hostile press conference in Vinto, Colonel Dion Ferreira, who's, as you can see from his beret, 3-2 Battalion Commander, he was the operational commander of Operations Modular Hooper and Packer. He was challenged by hostile press to respond to accusations that the South Africans had been beaten in the just concluded battles in Angola. Well, like a typical 3-2 Battalion, he answered, tongue-in-cheek, "If defeat for South Africa meant the loss of 31 men, 3 tanks, 5 armored vehicles, and 3 aircraft, then we lost. If victory for FAPLA and the Cubans meant the loss of 4,600 men, 94 tanks, 100 armored vehicles, 9 aircraft, and other Soviet equipment valued at more than a billion rand, then they won." Facts are stubborn things, such as the fact that Supreme Communist Commander for Angola, Cuban General Arnaldo Ocho Sanchez, was executed by firing squad less than a year later in Havana, Cuba. You do not execute commanders of victorious armies, not by their own side anyway. And he was a personal pal of Fidel Castro. He is one of the original. He is in charge of all communist forces in Angola. And they put General Arnaldo Sanchez against the wall and shot him. For losing the war against the fascist colonial running dogs and all the rest of it. I've walked in the graveyards of Soviet tanks, armored cars, and shot out equipment in Angola. I've numerous pictures of shot down Soviet aircraft. This was a crash landing. This MiG, this is a Mi-24 Hind helicopter shot to pieces. Another Mi-24 Hind helicopter gunship that's not going anywhere. And pictures of destroyed Soviet and Cuban tanks in Angola, some taken at the time, others taken later, of the wreckage that's still there today. I mean, you can go into Angola and it's still there. There's no doubt about who won the war in Angola. So here you are by the Lomba River, and here you can see one of the MiGs on the banks. The dismantled Iron Curtain also makes it clear who lost the Cold War. Coming down the Berlin Wall, Iron Curtain, this was the most epic event in my life. In the 58 years I've been alive, there was nothing more monumental than a coming down the Berlin Wall and the Iron Curtain. This was something that many people said would be up till Jesus came back. All over Eastern Europe, people celebrate. I'd smuggled Bibles into Eastern Europe with Bill Bathman early on in 1989, been as far as Czechoslovakia, through Romania, Hungary, down to Yugoslavia, and by the end of the year, they were all free, and thousands of idols of Lenin and Marx were being dismantled and taken to the trash heap. And celebrations all over Eastern Europe at the defeat of the evil empire. Today you can go to Angola and you'll see signs like this, just, you know, shut out tanks, tanks that are like playgrounds now for the kids. This is standard. In fact, you can Google Earth the Lomba River, and you can see from Google Earth evidence of the Soviet defeat. Hundreds of Soviet weaponry, like right here by the bridge, all these different shot out tanks and armored cars, and it's visible, especially in dry season. The Soviet weaponry destroyed decades ago on the Lomba River. The day a South African armored division, 61 mechanized division, shattered Angola's last mechanized offensive, they destroyed, I think it was the 47th Regiment, which was the president's own. It was dictator Fidel Castro's own mechanized presidential guard. The last hot battle of the Cold War, they called it. And so this has been well documented, not just by South Africans, British and other observers. The war for Africa, 12 months, had transformed the continent. So several years ago, I had the opportunity to speak with F.W. de Klerk, the previous president of South Africa. Now, the scenario was Daniela was singing in the place of the book, which is the old University of Good Hope. And President de Klerk's wife is a sponsor of the Cape Town Youth Choir. And so I had been sworn by Daniela to behave myself and not to pick a fight with de Klerk, because she knew that that's what I would have gladly done. The last time I'd met him, I'd refused to shake his hand. He had his hand out and I just stared at him. I wish I'd said something intelligent, but I was so angry at the time, I didn't think of anything to say. I just wouldn't shake his hand. What I would have liked to have said, if I thought about the time, is I don't shake the hands of people who shake the hands of terrorists, but I missed that opportunity. When you see red, you don't always think. But on this occasion, I decided, okay, how can I use this opportunity without embarrassing Daniela and being mean to this man? So during the break, during tea time, I walked up to him and I said, Mr. Klerk, have you seen the Mandela Long Walk to Freedom film? Because I'd like to know what you thought about how the negotiation process was depicted. So Mr. de Klerk smiled and said no, he hadn't seen the film and he had no intention of seeing the film, and he assured that it wouldn't have depicted the negotiation process accurately based as it is on Mandela's autobiography, Long Walk to Freedom. I then asked Mr. de Klerk if he could correct me if my perception was wrong. I said, we are continually being bombarded with disinformation that the ANC won the war and Mandela was gracious to his defeated enemies. I'd always thought the opposite was true. We had won the war, and our government had chosen to be gracious with our defeated enemies. My understanding is that after a series of stunning military victories in Angola, when we had thoroughly blunted and devastated the communist forces in Angola, with the Russians having withdrawn from Angola and the Cubans being withdrawn, and the Berlin Wall falling and the Iron Curtain collapsing, even as far as Ethiopia, where this idol of Lenin was being toppled outside Addis Ababa, as one country after another throughout Eastern Europe overthrew the communist dictators who had oppressed them for decades, our government in South Africa had chosen to seize the initiative and initiate negotiations with the ANC and other black nationalist groups in order to seek a peaceful resolution for all South Africans. That's what I said to him. At this, Mr. de Klerk nodded and agreed heartily. Yes, that is true, he said. We negotiated from a position of strength. The ANC had lost their Soviet sponsors, and we saw an opportunity to seize the initiative and resolve our problems in South Africa by bringing about a constitutional state where the rule of law would guarantee the rights of all. That's what Mr. de Klerk said to me. Mr. de Klerk then smiled and said, if we had wanted to, the National Party could still be the government of this country, and I could still be its president. Then he added, however, that would have been at the cost of many more lives lost in the ongoing war. I replied that there are many South Africans, including me, who would have gladly continued fighting against communism and terrorism, especially as even more had died from crime since than had even died in the war. Now, let me just stop for a moment and remind you that, if I remember right, the South African Defence Force lost 680 men in the 26 years of the war in Southwest Africa and Angola. Because 26 years war in Southwest Africa, 14 years war in Angola. We lost something around 680. Is that correct? I think that's the correct statistics. Now, during that same war, according to the South African Institute of Race Relations, 14,700 South Africans died in total in the 44 years of apartheid. So in 44 years of apartheid, 14,700 people died. At the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, Desmond Tutu and so on this propaganda stunt organized based on the show trials of Stalin, doubtless in the 1930s, but organized by Nelson Mandela, this TRC admitted that over 14,000 of those deaths had been done by the ANC and its allies. But they managed to come up with 500 deaths, which they attributed to the SADF, the South African Police, and other intelligence agencies, which included shooting rioters, terrorists, and assassinations of bombers and terrorists and so on. So according to the government's own TRC statistics, 14,700 died in the 44 years of apartheid, and they could attribute 500 of them to the southern government or its agencies, and they admitted over 14,000 were done by their freedom fighters. This means that, I mean, who's good at maths here? That means something in the region of 30 times more people, 30 times, that's like what, 3,000% more were killed by the ANC and its allies than by the government, by their own statistics. Well, I don't know how accurate those are, but I do know this. Back in 1960s, South Africa had an average of 167 murders a year. 167 people died of all violent kind of murder-related cases in a year. So about 167 homicides in a year. Under Mandela, it went up to 25,000 murders a year. We have had something in the region of 850,000 people murdered in the last 24 years of freedom, of which 85,000 would be, or about 10% would be, white people, of which 4,000 would be farmers and their family members. We have lost more farmers to murder than we lost soldiers in the whole 26 years of the war. So anyway, I didn't come up with all those stats then, I'm just interjecting, but bear in mind when people say, we had to do this because otherwise we'd still be at war. Well, actually, the war was not as bad as the peace has been in terms of the amount of people killed, the torturous deaths old people have suffered and things like that. But anyway, so I said, even more have died from crime since than even died in the war. I know, said Mr. de Klerk, but apartheid had to go. We could not fight for an unjust cause. I responded, my understanding is that apartheid had already been rejected by the white South African electorate in the 1983 referendum. 1983. Let me run. Not 93, that's not a typographical. We had a referendum in 1983, when I was 23 years old, and we voted overwhelmingly, and I was one of the people who voted yes for that. But yes, scrapping apartheid. And we brought in the tricameral parliament and a whole lot of other reforms under P.W. Botha's initiative. So I'm still speaking to Mr. de Klerk. I said, in fact, your predecessor, President P.W. Botha, had abolished virtually every apartheid law before 1989. By the way, 89 is when P.W. Botha resigned and when F.W. de Klerk became president. So I'm reminding him that apartheid had been abolished before he even became president. We were not fighting for apartheid, I said. We were fighting against communism and against terrorism. That is true, said Mr. Klerk. However, that is not the way the world saw it. Until they saw a black president over South Africa, they would not believe that apartheid was abolished. They didn't argue with my facts. I then said, Mr. de Klerk, do you believe that the ANC are being true to the agreement negotiated with your government in 1994? No, they are not, said Mr. de Klerk. We agreed to a constitutional state where the rule of law applies without any regard to race. Now, remember, we were at war. We were at a vicious war. Landmines, limpet mines, necklace murders, riots, terrorism, counterattacks, preemptive strikes. I mean, there's all sorts of things going on. Bombs, assassinations. To end the war and to prevent us going to a civil war, we came to an agreement. We negotiated from position of strength and to stop the war and sanctions. And to be honest, from South African perspective, from the white South African perspective, so that we could take part in the Olympics in Barcelona in 1992 and play rugby and cricket with the New Zealanders, Australians, and British, and so on. We basically voted to, in 1992's referendum, we voted to basically give the government a blank check to do something to bring this about. Now I wasn't agreeing to the 1992 referendum, but that I did vote no to. But anyway, he says we agreed to a constitutional state where the rule of law applies without any regard to race. Now, if this government wants to change the constitution to violate some of the most basic rights, like the right to property and protection of property, with no taking of property without just compensation by market forces and so on, if they want to violate that, they're destroying what the peace has been built on, however inadequate that peace has been. I then said, Mr. de Klerk, the many who are looking to you, notice I didn't say I was looking to him, but I was trying to be polite. Mr. de Klerk, there are many who are looking to you to set the record straight and remind South Africans and the world what was negotiated and what was agreed on in 1994. Mr. Klerk thanked me and assured me he had endeavored to do so through his de Klerk Foundation. I later wrote to him a letter reiterating what was said so I could get something in writing, and I got back a letter on his letterhead signed by him agreeing to the essential things and assuring that he would speak up for us, which he's done occasionally, a little bit. As Karl Marx declared, the first battlefield is a rewriting of history. And boy, have his disciples ever been busy rewriting history. See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the basic principles of this world rather than on Christ. We have to understand the Cold War context. This is a Soviet warship in the Angolan Luandan harbor. 1980s. It is impossible to understand recent South African history without understanding the Cold War and the very clear and present threat of Soviet expansionism and communist revolution. Context is everything. Many of you would have seen Dirty Harry film. And there's one particular scene where there's this wounded person running across a football field, and Dirty Harry pulls out his 44 Magnum and he shoots his chap in his leg, in his good leg, and he falls over. And then he walks coldly up to him and starts stepping on the leg and twisting his leg, and this man's screaming in agony. Now, if you just take that piece and you show that alone, what do you think? Police brutality. Why is he shooting and torturing this man? But if you know the context is there's a young girl kidnapped. She's buried in a place with a limited amount of air. She's dying of lack of oxygen. And he has got to find out where this kidnapper has placed her in order to save her life. Now, if you know that context, it changes everything. When you know the context, it changes it. If you just see a picture of a policeman baton charging some people and you say, oh, these police are terrible. But if you saw the necklace murder that the mob was guilty of, and then you see what the police were reacting to, now you suddenly think, why are they just baton charging? Why don't they shoot them? Because the context changes your perception completely. To understand the South African history, we need to understand the African context. The violence, the massacres, the lawlessness for life, dictators for life, what's it, presidents for life, that so often went along with decolonization process, like lining up people to a tree and shooting them by their own governments in the name of freedom. Idi Amin, monstrous dictator of Uganda, who murdered 650,000 Christians in the Ugandan Holocaust, who who is a Muslim, who declared he made Islam the official religion of Uganda, who killed and ate the Archbishop of the Church of England in Uganda. How many Rhodesian chiefs, village headmen, members of parliament, town councillors were shot by the ZANU terrorists? If we don't understand that, then we don't understand what led South Africans to naturally ensure that such things didn't happen here. You have got to understand the horror and the shock that was created by the Mau Mau atrocities in Kenya in the 1950s and the horrendous massacres in the Congo by the communist Simba terrorists in the 1960s. Everyone there knew about the Mau Mau and about the Simbas. These monstrous terrorists who did the most hideous atrocities and what they did to the Christians and what they did to farmers. And you've got to understand the Soviet threat. The Cold War was an ever-present reality from the 1950s through to the end of the 1980s. The Soviet Union and Red China really were arming and training Marxist revolutionaries throughout Africa. In 13 countries, tens of thousands of Cuban troops are propping up unelected Marxist dictators, all the way from Ethiopia to Sao Tome down to Angola and Mozambique. This is reality. But you don't get that in the Mandela Long Walk to Freedom film. There's not a Red Star, hammer and sickle. There's no mention of the Russians, the Cubans, the Cold War, the Soviet Union. Nothing about the context. You don't even hear about what wars were going on our borders or what atrocities were being carried out in communist countries across our borders. There were horrific atrocities taking place in Portuguese East and Portuguese West Africa, and Mozambique and Angola. The communist Frelimo campaign in Mozambique began with the decapitation of a Catholic priest in a church and the desecration of the altar with his head. In Angola, the Marxist MPLA began the campaign with a massacre of 43 men, women, and children who were literally fed through buzzsaws at a sawmill. Everyone knew that in South Africa. This is why we had the Suppression of Communism Act, Internal Security Act, and all these other things. The murder of whole families in Rhodesia, the landmine campaigns, the RPG and mortar attacks in farms, the limpet mines in railway stations and at shopping centres, the car bombs such as in Church Street, Pretoria, and the Kalahari Sands Hotel in Windhoek, and the ANC terrorist attacks in Sasol, the Caltex oil refineries in Cape Town. They lobbed mortars and shot RPGs into it. They would have liked to, you know what that would have done to people in Tableview, if you could have got that whole oil refinery up in flames, which they tried to blow up the Kuburg nuclear power station in the 1980s. I mean, this is the sort of people we've got in our government today. All of these are reminders that we were involved in the hot part of the Cold War. It wasn't that cold down here. To speak about the Cold War doesn't come close. It's dishonest of those reporting on South Africa in those years without recognizing a very real war that we were involved in. We were involved in a genuine, serious war against people who were attacking civilians, blowing up people. Now, for me to divert a bit, we were in touch at this stage with a Senator Jeremiah Denton. Jeremiah Denton actually became a rear admiral in the Navy. He was shot down and he spent 7.5 years tortured in the Hanoi Hilton, as they called the Vietnamese terrorist prison in the capital of Vietnam. Senator Jeremiah Denton was famous for when they forced him to make a propaganda film. He was blinking the whole time and people thought that's strange. Well, Navy people, he said, he's speaking to us in Morse code. And he is blinking with the eyelids in Morse code, torture. Explain why he was being forced to say these things. Well, he came out and he wrote the book When Hell Was in Session, which Ronald Reagan put the endorsement on the front cover. Now, Senator Jeremiah Denton is a friend. We knew him. He sent me hundreds of copies of his book. And by the way, I read this book just before I was captured and imprisoned in Zambia in 1987. And the insights he gave and how he survived mentally, emotionally, and everything else, how he handled torture and all that, was excellent in preparing me mentally for what we were going to go through, which was interesting. His secretary, one of his secretaries, Sharon Golden, later came and worked for our mission and then worked for Mrs. Scarborough's Gospel Defense League. So anyway, all this to say, Senator Jeremiah Denton organized a commission on Soviet subversion in Southern Africa, which we've got in our library. Soviet, East German, and Cuban involvement in fomenting terrorism in Southern Africa. So as chairman of the Subcommittee on Security and Terrorism in the U.S. Senate, Senator Jeremiah Denton organized what is now known as the Denton Commission. One of the star witnesses was Bartholomew Clapani. Bartholomew Clapani, this happened in 1982, this commission. So Bartholomew Clapani was a senior member of the Southern Communist Party, someone who knew Nelson Mandela personally. Bartholomew Clapani had been a Communist Party Politburo member, had been converted to Christ, and so he defected. So he went to Washington and he testified before Senator Jeremiah Denton's commission that there is nothing that the ANC does that is not determined, orchestrated, and completely controlled by the Southern Communist Party. And the Southern Communist Party, which he was also a member of, is completely controlled by the KGB. And it's not a decision that the ANC or the Southern Communist Party made, we're talking about the 1980s, without the Kremlin having initiated it in the Soviet Union. Now, this is during the Cold War. That it was, we were totally 100% a KGB operation. This is what he testified. Now, he came back, Bartholomew Clapani, to South Africa, and he was murdered in Soweto before the end of that year, December 1982. He was murdered with his wife as well in his home in Soweto by AK-47 wielding assassins of Nkuntwe Sizwe. His daughter, Pansy Clapani, was crippled in that attack. She would have been only about 12 or 13 at the stage, I think, because in 1987, I went to Germany with Pansy Clapani as part of a United Christian Action team. We were going to Kirchentag Church Day in Germany, Frankfurt. And Pansy was coming with us because Germany was about to put sanctions on South Africa. And this Kirchentag Church Day organized by the Lutheran Church was heavily pushing for that. So we went with a United Christian Action team from South Africa that included a whole range of interesting people like Damsankwa Linda, a black town councillor from Eastern Cape, and of course Pansy Clapani, who's paralyzed in a wheelchair. I was pushing a wheelchair on occasions to this conference. I saw Pansy Clapani threatened by communist thugs. They came up to her in Kirchentag, shaking boxes of matches in her face. "We're going to necklace you. When you get back to South Africa, we'll burn you alive." ANC thugs up there in Kirchentag threatening a paraplegic girl in a wheelchair, 18-year-old girl, who had seen her parents murdered just for her telling the truth of what was done to her parents. What kind of low-life scum does that? But that's some of the backstory of what happened after the Denton Commission came out. Now, most people in South Africa haven't even heard of the Senator Jeremiah Denton Commission or Bartholomew Clapani. Most South Africans don't even know who Pansy Clapani was. And why not? They know all sorts of things of somebody who got hurt by some apartheid policeman or whatever. I mean, those big pictures all over the place. I can't even find a picture of Pansy. I mean, I've searched. I was with her. We were around there. It's like the internet's been scoured. You can't even find pictures of Bartholomew Clapani, Pansy Clapani. They didn't just kill him. They erased their memory. I don't know how it is that something so public, you can't even find pictures of now. Romans 3 says, "Their deeds are evil deeds, and acts of violence are in their hands. Their feet rush into sin. They are swift to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are evil thoughts. Ruin and destruction mark their ways. The way of peace they do not know. There is no justice in their paths. They have turned them into crooked paths. No one who walks in them will know peace." Well, that's true for human depravity in general, but boy, is it ever true for communism. The New World Order worked hard at destroying those states that attempted to uphold Christian values. Hence the extraordinary international campaigns against Rhodesia. How could Rhodesia be called a threat to world peace? Rhodesian army was minuscule. The total airborne capacity of the Rhodesian army at the height of the war was, they managed to drop 185 airborne soldiers. That was the total with their 40 helicopters and planes, which was the total complement of the Rhodesian Air Force. They couldn't mobilize more. They couldn't even mobilize 200 airborne soldiers at one operation. Rhodesia had 40 helicopters at its height in the war. Total. I mean, America's pushed more than that off one aircraft carrier into the sea. It's just extraordinary how small Rhodesia was. Red China, with its nuclear weapons, they weren't a threat to world peace while invading Tibet and flame-throwing people and things like that. Apparently, the Soviet Union wasn't a threat to world peace. Cuba wasn't a threat to world peace. But Rhodesia was a threat to world peace. We were not even allowed to play in the Olympics. banned from even 1972 Olympics. Oh, Cuba could go, Saudi Arabia could go, but not Rhodesia, nor South Africa. We were banned from the Paraplegics Olympics. Why? And South Africa, was South Africa the worst country in the world in 1960s, 70s, and 80s? We were banned from just about every kind of sport that you could be banned from. Funny, in 1984, they had the Olympics in Seoul, Korea, where the South African flag flew at the war cemetery because South African pilots had died saving Korea from communism. But we couldn't attend even as spectators. South African passport holders were not even allowed to go there as spectators to the Olympics. Forget about participants. How petty is that? You're good enough to die for the country, but not to attend their sports. But did they hate us for our racial policies or having separate voters' roles? Or were they hating us because we banned pornography, banned abortion, and banned the Last Temptation of Christ, blasphemy? You've got to see Satan's strategy here. Many South Africans have recognized we do have a great calling, a great responsibility, and we're in the midst of a great conflict. I'm sorry this picture's cut off here. It's just believe in your God, believe in your people, believe in yourself. Just slogan for, I think, the 1985 elections. As Vladimir Lenin declared, whoever controls the tip of Africa controls the world. We want it for world communism. He recognized that already in 1918. In 1980, this was the situation we faced. Communism not only had most of Asia, it had Angola, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique, and Madagascar right in our borders. We had Soviet warships and Soviet helicopter gunships and jets right on our borders. In Battle for Africa, Brother Andrew of God Smuggler fame explained, the South African church is one of tremendous devotion to Christ. It is the spiritual muscle and the financial resources to reach Black Africa. I believe Satan is aware that South Africa has this potential and consequently works hard to isolate South Africa from the rest of the world. It has been singled out for boycott, embarrassment, and criticism, particularly, I believe, because Satan wants to isolate South Africa and prevent it from fulfilling its divine commission. The defeat of the Angolan forces in Angola, Afghanistan, Nicaragua, and the tidal wave of opposition to communism brought an end to Soviet control of Eastern Europe and the collapse of the Soviet Union itself. And it was that opened the way for ending the wars throughout Southern Africa and providing for elections in Namibia, Zambia, Angola, Mozambique, and South Africa. All of us were able to have elections immediately after the Soviet Union collapsed, showing they were the cause of the impasse. This resolved the conflicts which had raged throughout the Cold War. The Soviet Union communism was behind all these conflicts, and only once the Soviet threat was removed were all these countries able to secure internal settlements, for better or for worse. But Mozambique, Angola, Zambia, they all managed to have the elections after the war was over. Same with Namibia and South Africa. It was after the South African Defence Force's decisive military victories in the field that the National Party government decided to release Nelson Mandela and the other ANC and Communist Party officials from prison, in the hopes of bringing about negotiations that would bring an end to the violence and international isolation against South Africa. This is quite the reverse of what the state media and school textbooks would have us believe. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. This, by the way, is a bit of an insight into what it's like being up at UCT trying to speak with a Marxist or atheist. You might have libraries of reference in your mind, but they've got slogans in theirs. It's very hard to reason with people who can't think and read. Acquitting the guilty and condemning the innocent, the Lord detests them both. At the time of the war, at the height of the war in the 1980s, I remember General Sir Walter Walker, head of NATO, visiting the border and examining the Southern Defense Force units. Now, remember, he was head of NATO at the height of the Cold War. He quoted from the writings of the creator of Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and he quotes from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's book, The Great Boer War, to refer to the South African army at that time. Take a community of Dutchmen, of the type of those who defended themselves for 50 years against all the power of Spain, at a time when Spain was the greatest power in the world. Intermix them with the strain of those inflexible French Huguenots who gave up home and fortune and left their country forever at the time of the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. The product must obviously be one of the most rugged, virile, unconquerable races ever seen upon the earth. Take this formidable people and train them for seven generations. in constant warfare against savage men and ferocious beasts, in circumstances under which no weakling could survive. Place them so that they acquire exceptional skill with weapons and in horsemanship, and give them a country which is eminently suited to the tactics of the huntsman, the marksman, and the rider. Then, finally, put a finer temper upon the military qualities by dour Old Testament religion and an ardent and consuming patriotism. Combine all these qualities and all these impulses in one individual, and you have the modern Boer, the most formidable antagonist to ever cross the path of Imperial Britain. Our military history has largely consisted in our conflicts with France, but Napoleon and all his veterans have never treated us so roughly as these hard-bitten farmers with their ancient theology. He's talking about Calvinism. And the inconveniently modern rifles. There he refers to the Mauser 7.7. The Bitter Einde, this is the statue you have at the Anglo-Boer War Museum in Bloemfontein. Well, Sir Walter Walker applied that to the SADF, and he says, this is the finest army in the world. He said, there is not an infantry anywhere in the world who can compare, either in training or in abilities, with the Southern Defence Force. And in 1980s, we had the finest infantry in the world. 9 months training, intense training, at a time when the Americans were training people for 6 weeks and then throwing them into Vietnam. Our training was the most intense and brutal and demanding anywhere in the world. Not even the Russian infantry were trained as hard as ours were. Under the duties required in Ninth Command, the Westminster Larger Catechism lists the duty of preserving and promoting truth, the duty to stand for the truth and to do so from the heart, the duty to speak the truth and only the truth in matters of judgment and justice, the duty to speak the truth at all times, the duty to study and practice everything true, noble, lovely, and of good report. Under sins forbidden in the Ninth Command, the Westminster standards include the sin of giving false evidence, the sin of lying, the sin of concealing the truth, the sin of misconstruing intentions, the sin of exaggerating minor faults, and the sin of perverting the truth to wrong meaning, all of which our textbooks and our media are guilty of all the time. The way they slander well-meaning people who are trying to do the best they could during a hostile, volatile time during the Cold War to defend their country against communism and terrorism, and without mentioning the context and without mentioning the provocations, without mentioning the communist threat and the Soviet attacks, they make it out that all white people of that generation, like myself, who served in the SADF and so on, are evil, vicious, nasty racists. That is a lie. That is breaking every one of these commandments and applications of the Ninth Command. Truth is truth, even if no one believes it. And a lie is a lie, even if everyone believes it. The trouble is the lie that they're giving today is convincing people that it's commendable to steal from, torture, and murder white farmers. Propaganda kills. When you lie and you lie over and over, after a while, there's a bunch of people going to believe it, like the Malemas or whatever, who never lived under apartheid anyway, who have no idea what they're talking about, but they hate people for something that never happened to them, and they feel it justifies taking away their property, their life, everything. And the worst thing you can do to a person is to destroy his reputation, said John Calvin. And it's true. Give a dog a bad name, you might as well hang him. When you destroy people's reputation, when you take away their self-respect, when you take away their integrity, how is this going to empower anybody? You don't empower people with a lie. Some of you might have seen the film, is it Dark Knight? There was this Batman film where Harvey Dent's the criminal and he dies at the end of the film. But Batman goes along with a lie that Harvey Dent was actually a good person. He tried to save Gotham City. Some are thinking that this lie would comfort the people. And by the next film, you find out that, in fact, by the city worshipping and revering Harvey Dent, the whole city had been corrupted. Because you can't believe a lie without having negative influences. Remember that film? That's what's happened. We believe the lie, and a whole lot of people have gone along with it. Some whites have decided to go with a Stockholm syndrome. Let's cheer our oppressors and love our chains and everything will be better. But the Stockholm syndrome doesn't make things better either. A lie has negative consequences. Propaganda kills. We've had how many thousands of farmers tortured to death because of a bunch of people who believe a lie. They believe the propaganda. And there's other people who don't want to interfere with it because You mustn't mention a truth like I'm doing now, because it could make some people feel bad. Well, they need to feel bad if they've been encouraging genocide, theft, and mass murder. Minerals. It would be impossible to overemphasize the strategic importance to the industrial nations of the West or to the missionary enterprise of the church. Do you know we contain some of the world's largest known deposits of gold, platinum, chrome, manganese, vanadium, fluspar, and a whole bunch of other things. And do you know if you find a diamond on your farm, it belongs to De Beers. If you're scuba diving in the Orange River and you find a diamond, it belongs to De Beers. Every diamond in Namibia or South Africa belongs to De Beers. This is the most serious law in South Africa. The worst crime you can commit is illegal diamond buying. You get a worse sentence in jail for illegal diamond buying than for murder, torture, serial killing, or even tax evasion. I mean, it's even worse than that. The greatest crime in this country is illegal diamond buying, which could be a diamond you found on your own farm at the bottom of the river with scuba gear. It still belongs to De Beers. This tells you who actually runs this country. And by the way, it's the same today as it was in the days of Mandela, as it was in the days of Smuts. I mean, diamonds belong to De Beers. Understand? Most important thing. You break that rule, you're going to get the worst offense possible. That is what's behind. And by the way, who is the controller of Julius Malema? Lord Renwick. The same man who was the controller for Mandela. He organized the PR campaign that got Mandela elected in 1994 and so on. And we've got pictures, I don't have it here right now, of old Julius Malema going and having meals in London with Lord Renwick. Why does he have to go there? He's not a communist, really. He's not someone of people. He's not a real revolutionary. He's just a stooge for the same people who run the diamonds. And they've never changed those laws. The laws in this country still are basically diamonds are owned by De Beers. First M's mineral, second M is maritime. The Cape Sea Route's the busiest sea route in the world, with an average of 26,000 ships a year sailing past South Africa, past Cape Town. More than 30% of US oil imports, 50% of Western Europe's oil, 25% of Western Europe's food supplies travels around the Cape of Good Hope. And we have a phenomenal amount of ocean to control. Very, very important. Look at the size of the Russian area, or the Japan area, or the US area of naval. And now look at South Africa's size. The area South Africa Navy is responsible to patrol and to rescue any ships in distress. We've got a minuscule navy, a very, very, very small navy. And at its height, it wasn't that big. Not even 10% of South Africa's defense budget's ever gone to the navy. But our navy's done some phenomenal things. Our military, well, never was there a military anywhere in Africa that had such standards of discipline, of training, of, I mean, who does concrete block PT? It's just, who does this sort of thing? The paintain, no pain, no gain. Rifle PT, buddy PT, you've got to pick up your buddy with his kit, backpacks and rifles on, and run. And real live fire obstacle crossing. Actual stuff flying over you, metal flying around, explosions and all that sort of thing. You know, no place for those who've got height fright. But the SADF produced, you know, you take a young man whose mom couldn't get him out of bed and who wasn't able to make his bed. And then a few months later, he's making inspections to this kind of a level, even polishing olifant tanks. It's just phenomenal. At 19, our gap year was running around the bush and making decisions on which lives depended. Our lives and lives of others. And the fourth M is missions. South Africa is still the most important missionary sending nation in the Southern Hemisphere. The South African churches continue to form the most important missionary sending base for all of Africa. South Africa is the most important base for gospel radio broadcasts, for Bible translation and gospel literature production in the whole continent of Africa. And you can go to KwaZulu-Natal Mission. This whole mission here is the result of a revival that broke out in 1966. Reverend Erlo Stegen, German missionary, has turned KwaZulu-Natal Mission into a phenomenal place of revival. I said to Bill Bathman, as far as I can see, this is the greatest mission in Africa. Can you think of a better, bigger, or more blessed mission station in Africa? He said, Peter, you can upgrade that to the world. He said, I've been to 114 countries. You can confidently say KwaZulu-Natal is the greatest mission in the world. Well, I'll just stick to Africa because I haven't been around the whole world, like Bill Bethlen has. The king of the Zulus calls Ulo Stegan God's apostle to the Zulus. King Goodwill's Valentini says nobody speaks better Zulu than Ulo Stegan. He has the best diction, the best pronunciation. I learned my Zulu from Ulo Stegan. He's got a higher standard of Zulu than the king has. That's what the king says. This mission station is a place of real blessing and revival. Just phenomenal what they've achieved. And Ulo Stegan celebrated recently 60 years in ministry. I think he's now 83. 60 years he's been preaching gospel in Zulu. Since he is 16 years old, he's been preaching the gospel, winning souls to Christ. When he was 16, he is starting out going with tent evangelism. My daughter Andrea and I are visiting Ulo Stegan's latest pet project of planting a new mission at Tugela Valley. This is very, very, very close to Nkandla. In fact, Jacob Zuma is his close neighbor. The people love him. Another mission station, back to the Bible Training College. What a phenomenal work run by General Scheimelder. And here we are up in Nairobi with one of the Great Commission conferences that I ran there. And you can see one pale face right in the middle there. And these people keen for missions. All over, we can show examples of enthusiasm for missions. And of course, from this mission base, we are sending out tons of literature. In fact, I think this year, thinking of what our team did up in the Noob Mountains as well, we're probably going to be close to 200 tons of Bibles, books, Sunday school materials, tracts distributed this year, especially with the greatest Bible distribution ever done in the Noob Mountains of Sudan. But this is what's at stake. This is a spiritual war. First and foremost, this isn't about politics. This isn't about race. This is about God versus Satan. This is the kingdom of God versus the kingdom of Satan. People's lives at stake. Not just lives. This is lives for eternity. And what's it been at stake from the very beginning is the kingdom of God being attacked by the kingdom of Satan. I don't see this as political or racial as much as spiritual. This is a spiritual war. It's a war for the soul of Africa. And it's being fought in Africa right now. In his book, Battle for Africa, Brother Andrew declares in his chapter, One Nation Could Save All of Africa, I believe that God has a special interest in the survival of the South African nation. The continent of Africa is the special spiritual responsibility of South Africa. Why? Because South Africa has the tools to reach the entire continent. It has the money, the technology, and a large number of committed Christians. It has the freedom and relative political stability. Everything's relative. It has everything needed to evangelize the continent of Africa, to equip black Africans and other countries to participate in the process and to get the job done all the way from the Cape of Good Hope, that's where we are now, to the Sahara Desert, where Hunter and John were not that long ago in May. And I further believe that God will intervene in the course of history to preserve South Africa if her people will accept her responsibility to evangelize the rest of the continent. We are a country with a mission, and it's not just Brother Andrew. Lauren Cunningham, the founder of International Youth with a Mission, said when he was visiting South Africa, God will save your country if you will send your young people to the ends of the earth with the gospel. At the Great Voortrekker Monument in Pretoria, a wall mural recalls the symbolic gift of a Bible from the English-speaking 1820 settlers to departing Voortrekkers and said, God has placed us at the foot of Africa to take the light of the gospel of Christ throughout Africa. That's what I believe. That's what we're here for. That's what we exist for, to take the gospel to the utmost parts of the earth, to bless all the nations. Let the earth hear his voice. So, any questions, any comments? Who won the war and who initiated the peace? Questions, comments, complaints?
We never ever saw Mkhonto-N says we fight as ever in 1981. We never even heard of them. There was no army.
No.
There was just nothing. They were, you know, non-existent. So it was very strange for us to see now suddenly these 2,000 fighters, you know, all these Mkhonto-N
war veterans.
War veterans. What a joke. I mean, they never fought battles anywhere ever. Never, ever. We never, ever encountered ANC fighters ever.
There was no uniformed or platoon, not even platoon strength, nothing. All they had was a guy who could deliver a limpet mine or a suitcase bomb or a car bomb somewhere. That was about the limit of it.
Russian forces, back forces, nothing.
There's more validation to give them tons of money.
Oh, it's That's what it's all about. When you get down to it, it's about money. It's about greed. I mean, that's at the end of it. But the thing is, in the meantime, you know, I think in 1994, there was a lot of us who just wanted to give it a chance, make it work, and we're willing to let bygones be bygones, let the past be the past. But no, these idiots have to keep lying and lying and lying. And after a while, this new generation who doesn't know it's a lie and actually might even believe this stuff. And they now think it's right and justifiable and ethically justifiable to murder and torture people to death because they've believed the lie. And that's why the truth is so important, because we are at peace because we won the war and we initiated a peace from a position of strength. And now if these guys are going to keep believing the lie, they're going to justify genocide, a new civil war, and this is going to be like Rwanda or worse.
I mean, the South African army was very strict in the way you dealt with locals. You weren't allowed to do anything bad to them. They were very, very strict and very hard. And you had to pray. I wasn't a Christian then, but you had to pray every time you went out and take your hats off. And, you know, it was like really serious.
A lot of sneers and bit.
Yeah.
And that was an order.
It was heavy on you on discipline and dealing with the locals. And you had to be, you know, you get arrested for anything. You know what I mean?
Yes. Oh, when I speak in America and I say, in the Southern Defense Force, pornography is illegal, blasphemy is illegal, and they're like, what?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. they have no idea of the discipline we had in our army.
Yeah. Yes. Did you have any problems from, say, South Africans who were communists in the army?
You know, if they were there, they didn't say a word. There was a group called End Conscription Campaign who refused to go to the army. Their headquarters for Cape Town was just down the road here. Rondebosch Congregational Church, Douglas Bax, had the End Conscription Campaign, ECC. We used to call it Every Coward's Choice. There were a few people there, and I don't know that they were communists. Some of them might have been. Some were just well-meaning liberal people, pacifists. Or maybe there were people who wanted to stay home and be close to their girlfriend, didn't want to go to the border. I don't know what was the motivation of all the ECC people, but I do know this. When the Soviet files were opened in 1991, we discovered that the End Conscription Campaign and the Southern Council Churches was a project of the KGB's active measures. And they put millions and millions and millions of rubles into just the End Conscription Campaign in South Africa, not even counting CDN and CND in Britain and Southern Council Churches, and a whole bunch of groups on a university campus. So active measures, South Africa was saturated with thousands of millions of rubles worth of Soviet active measures activities, which now we know, but of course, who wants to publish it and who wants to know about it and might make somebody feel bad. So let's rather murder people because of a lie than tell the truth and embarrass some of the liars.
I do know that one of the Navy commanders was working for the Russians throughout the war.
Not just the Navy commander, he was the officer commanding Simonstown, the most important. He was a spy, and his wife, they were both imprisoned, and later they were released by Mandela when he became president. But yes, do you remember that character? That was a shock. I think that's 1982 or 83. We suddenly discovered, and even Britain was shocked because they knew Simonstown's the most important naval installation in the Southern Hemisphere, and the man running it was a KGB operative. That was very serious. There's so many things on the go. You know, it's like speaking about Randy Weaver, where you discover that conspiracy theorist. He thinks the government's got black helicopters and they're going to they want to kill you. Next thing, there are black helicopters around his home and they're killing his wife and killing his son. And he realized, well, maybe he wasn't a conspiracy theorist after all. Maybe he's right. Well, people were saying the communists were trying to take South Africa and others were ridiculing it. In fact, in the so-called recce film now, they have the general, there's no such thing as a communist threat. The general saying that. We had thousands of Soviet tanks and armored cars on the borders, multiplied hundreds of their top-of-the-line MiGs and helicopter gunships in the neighboring. We had these submarines come around here. I've got pictures of the naval planes going around, tracking the different Soviet warships coming around our shores around South Africa. Cape Town was always being monitored. There were Soviet warships all over the place. Why would they be doing that if they didn't care? Why would they be planting the people right in to take over Simonstown naval base if there wasn't a communist threat? And so now today people acting like, you know, there were these Afrikaners in southern Tip Africa who woke up one morning and said, I know what, let's be mean to our neighbors. Let's institute apartheid just to aggravate and irritate people. No context. You know, forget about Dingaan and massacring Piet Retief after signing an agreement with them. Forget about Blokrantz and forget about the Diffikon and all of these things. Who needs to know anything about the Soviet Union, the Cold War, the Simbas, the Mau Mau, and all the massacres that are going on all around Africa and the threats around our borders and in our streets, even Church Street, Pretoria, where you would have thought you're as safe as anything. Car bomb going off there. Or people trying to blow up the Kubik nuclear power station in Cape Town in the 80s too. But you're not meant to talk about these things because these facts ruin a good story. We've got a nice narrative. Let's just keep with the narrative and leave facts out of it. And then you get pains in the neck who commit thought crimes by presenting facts like I have tonight, which is treason and heresy to the New World Order and this new Mandela Mania religion that we've got out here. We're not meant to bring the facts in because that ruins the story. It's like Harvey Dent must be the hero of Gotham City. Must let the people know what Harvey Dent really was like. If I can use a fiction example.
And none of the soldiers thought it was a fight between black and white. You know what I mean? We fought with black soldiers from different nations.
Every tribe, yeah.
You know what I mean? Tribes. And we were the first guys to vote yes, you know, for change.
And yeah.
And it was against Russia. We had no, everybody understood that. I mean, Operation Protea, we captured fields and miles and kilometers of Russian equipment and BTRs and tanks. And it was crazy, you know what I mean? No one ever thought it was any other battle.
Well, what were the Bushmen fighting for? What were the Vambos fighting for? What was the Zulu 121 Battalion fighting for? What do all these Portuguese-speaking black Angolans and Faplu had come over by the thousands to join 3-2 Battalion fight for? So what were they fighting for? Are you going to tell us the Bushmen of 3-1 Battalion and the Portuguese-speaking Angolans of 3-2 Battalion were fighting for apartheid? What were Vambos fighting for? The fact is, while whites people were conscripted to go to the army, all the black people in SADF were volunteers. Like Rhodesia, the whites were conscripted, the black people were volunteers. But in the Rhodesian army, 85% of the army were black. In South Africa, it might have been, what, 35, maybe 40%?
Yeah.
I mean, most were white, but there were about 35 to 40% would have been black volunteers. And up at the border, 3-2 Battalion probably saw more action than most units. 3-2 Battalion was in there. And what were they fighting for? They were fighting against communism. They were fighting for freedom from communism. They were fighting to protect their families from communism. I don't know if there was one soldier that I've ever met who was fighting for apartheid. All the soldiers I knew were fighting communism and terrorism. And, you know, even when I met Nelson Mandela, I told him that. Yeah. His first question to me was, "So, Mr. Hammond, what were you doing in the years of struggle?" I said, "I was fighting people like you, sir." And Mandela slapped his knee, stood up, smiled, shook my hand a second time, said, "I'm so glad to meet an honest white man." And he said, "All the people I've met so far have been saying they were on my side and against the National Party government." He said, "I don't know how National Party stayed in power for 44 years when everyone supported me." And I said, "Well, Mr. Mandela, make no mistake, we were not fighting for apartheid. We were fighting against communism and terrorism." And, I mean, that's the point. Now, no, that's what General Constant Viljoen was thinking. That's what General Kurt Liebenberg was thinking. That's what Shai Mulder was thinking. That's what Heldenes, all of these people, it was all about communism and terrorism and fighting for freedom. It was nothing about race politics. I remember General Heldenes making a speech. It was actually a famous speech where he said, "The army is not fighting for political ends, but we are providing a shield behind which the politicians must resolve the problems in this country. We can only do this for a time, but you must solve the problems. We're just giving you breathing space by keeping the external threat out. The army is not fighting for any particular political resolution. What we're fighting for is the freedom for South Africans to make resolutions. Don't waste your time. Get on with it," basically, if I can summarize. That was the kind of mentality. The army was not pushing a political agenda. It was just trying to keep communism and terrorism out. But this needs to be said. But now, to have them lie, and I know they lie because when our son Calvin got an experience of an independent Christian school and a break from homeschooling, he's being taught in a classroom by the history teacher and so on that his dad and grandfather's generation are evil people. And you know, all racist and this. And you know, he'd come back scoffing at it because he knew this was rubbish. But the kind of rubbish they give you, and this is in a so-called independent Christian school. I mean, what's the government school saying? Well, I know what they're saying, actually. And you can't lie without negative consequences coming out of it. And you can't put up with a lie without negative consequences. And negative consequences is seen. Now, there's a bunch of people saying, because all white people are thieves, racists, and murderers, and rapists, therefore, we must take all land from them, and this is just reconciliation and so on. And the only reason we're even having this discussion about should we commit national economic suicide by destroying the agricultural sector of the country and destroying race relations and destroying our credibility in the eyes of the whole world is because a whole lot of people have been fed a steady diet of lies for so long. So, you know, what I've said tonight wouldn't have sounded that strange 24 years ago. 24 years ago, a lot of people say, well, why are you saying this? We all know this. But now, this is like a Martian has landed and you're hearing some alternative view of reality. But this is the reality. And right now, we've been living in this Harvey-Dentized society where everything is light is darkness is light, right is wrong is right, sweet for bitter for sweet, inverted reality. And if you try and point out the emperor has no clothes or that sort of thing, everyone might know that you're telling the truth, but you know that you're not allowed to say that. You're meant to just repeat after me the mantra and so on. Yes?
How serious do you think the government will be regarding Marxism?
Very serious. What we are seeing right now, we've documented newsletters are on the table and at the back and so on, in the hallway as well. Is South Africa entering second phase of the revolution? Yes, it is. This is Marxist agenda. In 2013, the African National Congress, 2012, the African National Congress had a policy conference and they adopted a policy document, which I've waded through, although it's called the second phase of transformation, the words revolution and psychological warfare and battle for hearts and minds and all that sort of thing and struggle is used over 100 times in the 70-page document. They adopted, even though they changed the title from second phase of the revolution to second phase of transformation at the end, the whole content document is second phase of the revolution. And then the very next year, their youth leader, Julius Malema, conveniently leaves and starts the vanguard of the revolution, the EFF, who, at first, people thought this is a breakaway from the ANC. But now it's becoming clear, this isn't a breakaway from the ANC. This is the ANC. It's just the vanguard of the revolution, you can see, because Julius Malema proposed this bill at the end of February this year for removing this constitutional safeguards of 25 and that you can expropriate property without compensation. And at that moment, every single ANC member in parliament, including Cyril Ramaphosa, voted for the Julius Malema EFF proposed bill. Now, if Julius Malema was a traitor, a deserter, the ANC wouldn't have supported. Even if they agreed with it, they would have proposed their own bill. They would have voted his down so as not to give him the credibility, and they would have made their own bill, even if they used it word for word. The fact that they voted 100% in unity together shows that the ANC and EFF are the same thing. But the EFF is plausible deniability for the same reason that the government might use some barriers between, so at the end of the president, well, I don't know. We were selling arms to the Contras. Who knew? Plausible deniability, as Colonel Oliver North testified, well, we were there for plausible deniability so that the administration can say that we didn't have anything to do with it if something goes wrong. So what the EFF, the Everything for Free Party, is out there for is they testing the waters. Now, if things go really bad, and for example, somebody in the West grows a backbone and says, cease and desist. Don't even think about it, or you're going to lose everything. No more foreign aid, recalling your loans, sanctions, can't even attend sports and Olympics and so on and so forth. And they say, well, no, that wasn't our idea. That's just this Julius Malema and the EFF. So they've got plausible deniability if it goes wrong. But if they get away with it, they can take it the whole way. But they've got a vanguard of the revolution to take the blame if things go wrong. And so basically it shows the ANC doesn't have the confidence to do it in their own name. They want another entity to lead it so that they could pull back if they get opposition. This gives one hope, because this means if there is serious opposition, both internally and externally, and we need both. We've got elections coming up next year about May. That's seriously important. There's a massive backlash against both ANC and the EFF. But also, if we can get our friends and family overseas to put a lot of pressure, I believe they will back off. And if the government wants to and needs to, they can jail Malema. They can ban the EFF. I mean, they can do whatever they want because they've got no sense of loyalty even to their own, as we know. I mean, Stalin killed Trotsky and Mugabe murdered Josiah Tongarara, who is the head of the Zanla army, and they do this sort of thing all the time. The founder of Frelimo, Eduardo Mondlane, was murdered by Michelle, who now then named the main street and the main university after the founder of the movement, which he killed. So communists are like this. They don't mind stabbing in the back their own people. But the EFF is there as the vanguard of the revolution. This is the second phase of the revolution. But if it goes wrong, they can ditch it. And they keep their hands clean, so to speak.
I can't understand why they go this route if they know that communism does not work.
Right. I understand what you're saying.
To overthrow a country, absolutely.
Yes.
But financially.
No. Exactly. But we can see communism doesn't work. I mean, it's been tried 57 times. It's failed every one of the times. It's complete and utter total failure. It's economic suicide. Zimbabwe is enough example. But, I mean, we've got a lot of others. Like all of them. Cuba and so on. But to get power, to stay in power, and to enrich yourselves at the top, it does well. So as long as you don't care about the country, as long as you're just a selfish megalomaniac like Mugabe, it works for you. Yeah, it doesn't work for anyone else.
Yes.
But so if the masses, the povo, as they call them, if the masses on the street realize they're being used, they might turn the revolutionary fervor against the powers above them to direct them. Because that's what happened in Mozambique. That's what happened with RENAMO. RENAMO was founded by ex-Frelimo, who said, in fact, I heard it from Alfonso de Cama, the head of RENAMO at the time. He says, I was an officer in Frelimo. I was fighting for Frelimo. I was fighting against the Portuguese. But then I realized we exchanged Portuguese colonials for Russian colonials, and the Russians were worse. The revolution being betrayed. We went back to the bush and started fighting again. So you do get counter-revolutionaries. That's what they were. They're revolutionaries who later worked against the revolution that they first worked for. RENAMO was made up of ex-Frelimos who realized we've been lied to, we've been deceived, we've been had. That's why often the revolutionaries kill their own as soon as they get into power, because they know that we can't trust them. If they help to overthrow the previous government, they might overthrow us too. So the thanks that many of the vanguard of the revolution get is often a bullet in the back of the head and some gulag. Like General Sanchez, buddy, one of the closest, one of the original seven of Fidel's revolution, when he failed, put him against the wall and had him shot. I mean, can you imagine? But then again, the Americans murdered General Patton, their war hero. If you can have a government murdering their own heroes, then that's what they're worth. If we could just convince and reach the people on the ground to realize these people who are promising you prosperity are lying and acting like they care about you. The only reason you're poor is because of the corruption of government. They are being told there's something wrong in the country. Well, we can all see there's something wrong in the country. But then they get a smokescreen and a, what do you call it, a scapegoat. The scapegoat is the white farmers. They're to blame. What, those 26,000 farmers are feeding everyone, they're the ones to blame for the mess in the whole country? Yes! It's not the fault of the people who've been running the country for the last 25 years. They're overtaxing you, who've caused rampant inflation, and who are so corrupt they're stealing a quarter of the GDP every year. Forget about the trillions they're stealing. The real problem is the statue of old Cecil Rhodes up top there and the statue of old Jan van Riebeeck down there, and these white farmers, they're the problem. Now, unfortunately, many of the people out there probably believe this propaganda. But if they could realize they've just been distracted, had, and used by people who will throw them to the walls. Like, what happened to all those war veterans in Zimbabwe? Do you know most of the war veterans in Zimbabwe are now voting for the MDC opposition, the so-called war veterans of Zimbabwe? And they realized Mugabe betrayed them. Total betrayal. Or they fled the country. And then, so all these people with the EFF who are campaigning for this, once they've got rid of the farmers who employ and feed everyone, and they've chased away all investor confidence, tourists and everything else, and nobody's got any jobs, and they're starving, what's going to happen to them? They're going to have to flee, go to a refugee camp, be fed by some Peace Corps relief agency thing from America? I mean, where's the dignity in that? If they survive. They might not even survive at all. But this is what's happened in all the revolutions over the whole world. Do you know even Fidel Castro's daughter fled from Cuba? His daughter fled and testified against her father for being a mass murdering thug. I mean, that's pretty bad. Now, who knows what's going to happen in this country? But at the moment, this is the time still. It hasn't come to shooting war yet, unless you're on the farm being attacked tonight. But at this moment, it's still a battle for tomorrow. So the newsletters we've produced, especially the last three Christian actions dealing with these issues, let's get them into the hands of people. The videos, screen captures of these presentations we've been giving this year here, and the audios and the articles you can link and share. Let's get people overseas to mobilize pressure on their governments to put pressure on our government to cease and desist instantly. This is right now still it's a war for information. If we can get the information out, and as you say, where's this worked? What's the normal consequence of communism, socialism, second phase of the revolution, land invasions, etc.? It doesn't make any sense if you want what's good for this country. It only makes sense if you're a Marxist megalomaniac who doesn't care about the people and you're totally selfish and you know you'll build something okay even if the rest of the country goes down the drain. But I think what's happening is the ANC knows they've failed. I mean, they promised so much. And every year we've added 1 million unemployed to the ranks. We've got more unemployed in the country now than there were people in the country in 1994. We had 2 million unemployed and 28 million people in the country in 1994, and 70,000 farmers who were feeding 100 million people. That was 1994. That's when we had 2 rand to the dollar. Now, with 14, 15 rand to the dollar, we've got 26,000 farmers feeding 40 million people, but our population has increased to 59 million. We've got 30 million of the people in this country unemployed. More people unemployed than employed in this country right now. Even though the play games were saying unemployed, discouraged work seekers, economically inactive, and what's the difference? You know, if you put it all together, you see we at over the 50% mark in unemployed. So they've got to either say we're a useless government, we're totally corrupt, and we failed, or they've got to say it's somebody else's fault, and we know which they've chosen. But after you've played all these rules, at the end of the day, I mean, what's at the end of it? Somewhere along the line, like Zimbabwe, the economy breaks, a $100 trillion note can't buy half a loaf of bread, and half the population flee. Except in this case, where would we flee to? Kind of at the end of the line. So the Zimbabweans, by the millions, fled here. So they're in a corner, and we're not as decentralized as Zimbabwe. We're a very urbanized country. Not many people even know how to be a subsistence farmer. If the commercial farmers are removed from the equation, there's only starvation. And then you've got chaos. And because Zimbabwe, there's a safety valve, they could flee across the border. Here, there's no safety valve. So the situation would be much worse than Zimbabwe. We know Zimbabwe is a failure. But that's why a bit of logic would help. The trouble is, when you're dealing with people whose mind only has slogans in it, and they're shouting out slogans and they're not thinking, and they won't listen to facts or reason. That's the problem. That's where it helps if we can get overseas governments to actually make things possible. To say, no, don't even think about it. You go down that road, these are the consequences. And they can shut this government's program down, if there's any will. But remains to be seen, do we have anyone in the backbone in the Western world? Theresa May obviously doesn't. But Donald Trump, there's still hope that he might just do the unpopular thing, if one could reach him, if anyone knows anyone who's got any connections, I'm inclined to think if he really believed something, he would do it, even though his government would probably have a fit. Still, we've got social media, we've got international connections. There's probably more South Africans living outside the country right now than in here. So I think we've got a lot of people who could put pressure to bear. We've seen it work in Australia. South Africans in Australia made quite a scene. And that embarrassed this government already. And that made them step back a few steps, delayed things. And that's really a start. Imagine if we really mobilised our families and friends, we could really get some pressure to bear.